So on that note, I want to bring on our first guest for today to talk about, you know, what this is going to mean for the world. I mean, when you have a clash of Turkey getting involved with Russia, well, I want to bring on our first guest for today, James Corbett, and to get his analysis on what this could potentially mean for everyone. So joining us on the line, we have James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. James, thanks for joining us today, man.
Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be here. I just wish we could be talking about something happier than the current circumstances.
Yeah, well, I know. It is what it is, right? Here's where we're at. And now we have Turkey getting more so involved in escalating this situation. So what's your take from today's news and the results of this plane being shot down? And do you think this could lead to some sort of a NATO response because of today's what happened today?
Well, obviously, the details that we're getting about this incident are spotty right now, and there's still a lot of fog of war around the reporting of it, so I don't think we can draw any definitive conclusions about it, but it's difficult to even fathom how this could possibly have taken place. This is not even remotely in Turkey's interests. I don't know why they would have done this. I don't think there would have been a reason for it. It could have been a hot-headed situation where this got out of their control. But however that plays out, certainly Turkish-Russian relations, at the very least, have been damaged, if not completely severed at this point, which is not good for Turkey because, of course, they were hoping to be the alternative to Russia's crushed Southern Stream pipeline dreams. They were going to have that Turkish stream. One would imagine things like that are going to be kiboshed right now because of this. So there's a whole lot of mess this creates, even disregarding whether or not we're looking at immediate military escalation. I tend to think this will not be the start of whatever military conflagration, but the fact that Turkey is holding some sort of NATO consultation at the moment is worrying in and of itself because, I mean, Turkey can drag NATO into a full-scale war, which, let's be reminded, just a year and a half ago, it came out that Turkish officials had been plotting to do a false flag in Syria on Turkish targets in Syria in order to get NATO into Syria, boots on the ground at that time. So Turkey is not above this kind of calculation if what they're trying to do is start some sort of apocalypse, but I just don't see why Turkey would be doing it at this point. So I tend to think this is not going to be the start, but certainly this is a huge escalation in this kind of proxy war tension that is obviously starting to boil over now between Russia and NATO.
Well, speaking of this proxy war, let's touch on that about who specifically is responsible for this. I mean, Putin just suggested at the G20 that over 40 nations are actually the ones funding ISIS, some of those being ISIS. G20 nations actually doing the funding. So I think in order to understand this proxy war, we have to fundamentally understand where is this all stemming from. So it's very confusing for people out there. I mean, you know, you got Russia fighting ISIS, America's apparently fighting ISIS, but they don't want Putin's help. And, you know, it's like a psychological warfare on the people. So, you know, what's your take on that? Whereas a few years ago, the war drums were beating towards Syria, and now the debate, the conversation has shifted, and people are almost ready to go into Syria.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been a 180-degree shift in the mainstream discourse from a couple years ago where we had that hands-off Syria campaign and people, you know, protesting literally out on the streets, waving banners and placards, don't go into Syria. I think it may not be quite the exact opposite at this point, but we're getting there where people are now at least happy to see some sort of military response to Paris, for example, and the way people are being basically dog whistled along the path that we always are in the event of any terrorist incident. So yes, there's been a fundamental transformation taking place here. And I think that one of the fascinating things to watch is the way the MSM is twisting itself into pretzel knots, trying to come up with some sort of narrative as to why, yes, ISIS is the biggest threat to humankind, and we, you know, of course we have to devote our whole force, our whole energy and military might towards defeating this insuperable enemy. But Russia, who is fighting them, is also bad, so them fighting them might actually be a bad thing, and we might have to kind of team up with ISIS against Russia. It's just amazing to watch this playing out, because they really are pressing as hard as they can on the Orwellian thought control button right now to try to get people to, into that doublethink mentality. And they've been doing it for a few years ago. Remember a couple of years ago, there was a CFR editorial, literally on CFR.org's blog page, one of the CFR fellows or whatever wrote this blog about how Al-Qaeda is now our friend in Syria. We need them now in places like Libya and Syria, where they're fighting against our shared enemies. And again, I mean, you couldn't, if you'd said that 10 years ago, people would have laughed in your face. Oh yeah, US teaming up with Al-Qaeda, ridiculous. But now they're doing it. And now ISIS is our enemy, but they're also kind of our friend if they're against the Russians. It's amazing to watch this spilling out, as I say, and I guess the disturbing corollary of that is that there are a lot of people who are actually somehow buying into this. They're turning their brain off and just going along with whatever they're being told at the moment, which is that ISIS is bad and Russia is bad, but ISIS might be good when they're against Russia, but Russia might be kind of good if they're against ISIS, but not all the time. And it's just going to be interesting to see how specifically this Turkish incident is going to be played in the MSM.
Well, James, I'm also curious, as a Canadian, what are your thoughts on some of Justin Trudeau's response to this? I mean, he recently said that, yeah, we're going to pull out of the fight in Syria against ISIS, but he said what we're going to in fact do is train some of the militant groups there who are working to fight against them. But, I mean, that's how we got into this problem in the first place. So what are you taking away from what we're hearing from the newly selected Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau? In regards to how he's going to handle this situation.
Yeah, exactly. His promises aren't coming to fruition. Who would have guessed it? You're right. He promised to withdraw the combat forces from Syria that have been deployed under Operation Impact, and he said they're going to be still, of course, have troops on the ground training the rebels, as you say. Rebels, terrorists, let's call them what they are, our terrorists, of course, not the bad terrorists, the good terrorists, which is a ridiculous position on its face, and only as it's just the other wing of that bird of prey that Harper was the other wing of. But let's look at the actual Operation Impact itself and what it's doing there, and the fact that it's probably not going to wind down in the way that Trudeau was saying before he got selected. But here it is. If you go to the forces.gc.ca official homepage about Operation Impact, they say that this, in talking about Islamic State, they say the group began taking control of territory in Iraq and Syria in 2014, starting with Fallujah in Iraq in January 2014 and culminating with the fall of Mosul in June 2014. Its rapid advance across Iraq and Syria has displaced millions of people, has undermined stability in Iraq and the region, and poses a threat to international security. So this is why Canada has committed its forces, including six CF-18s, one Polaris aircraft refueler, and two CP-140M Aurora surveillance aircraft to this mission. But that narrative that they're talking about there is the exact evidence of, well, what we already know from a million other sources, but the fact that the Islamic State has been allowed to rise, has been protected, specifically protected and fostered by the NATO allies, who did nothing to stop the big convoy across the desert as they swept over to Mosul back in the summer of 2014. Something that would have been, I mean, even if there was no intelligence whatsoever that this was happening or was going to happen, the fact that it did happen under the surveillance, the satellite surveillance watch of the CIA and every other alphabet soup agency of, you know, however many other governments watched that happening and allowed it to happen, that is the narrative that they're asking us to believe. Oh, somehow this just all happened, and who would have known it? And now the narrative is even more ridiculous, where we're expected to believe they're making $1.5 million a day in oil sales from their captured oil fields that are being sold via these smugglers and then somehow smuggled out into international markets, including through Turkey, somehow or other. And, you know, who can possibly keep track of all of this? And I don't have the name of the company right now, but there is a company that that a certain Rothschild, one of the members of the Rothschild family, is invested in, that got involved in Syria shortly before, I think, the outbreak of this, the whole war situation started. And although the stock price of that company has obviously fallen during the war because, you know, it's in such chaos. But it's interesting to think who is on the other side of these oil trades that are somehow or other making it out into the international oil markets. Could there be these international corporations, these multinationals puppeteered by the Rothschilds and others that have been already in there with the infrastructure in place that are using the smugglers to get the oil out at jacked up rates? I wonder if there's some connection going on there. But anyway, I'm sure that will never be looked into. But I think that's another aspect of this. The oil infrastructure and the financing is, of course, another way this is all being protected, even as we're supposedly at war with these people. And they don't want to bomb oil truckers and things like that because, well, those are just innocent people. Well, they never apply that logic in any other situation where anyone that they kill who is between the ages of 18 and 55 or whatever it is by definition an enemy combatant. Just being that age and being a male in an area where they are conducting military operations makes you a valid target, but apparently not in the Islamic State's territory for smugglers who are working and actively collaborating to help finance the Islamic State. I mean, these are just a few of the lies, top to bottom, that have permeated this Operation Impact that Canada's involved in, and that's the story that, of course, is not being told to the Canadian public, who are going to be fed this narrative. Islamic State, who could have seen it coming? We're there to stop them, and so we have to continue to commit our forces. And the same brainwashed masses who voted Trudeau into office are going to be completely in support of this. Yeah, he promised to get us out of there, but he's not going to because we don't want to anymore. And the status quo will be upheld as always.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about the other narrative going on throughout all of this. And that is this concept of ISIS militants being embedded within the Syrian refugees. This has caused great concern worldwide, especially after the Paris attacks, allegedly there being a passport from one of the Syrian refugees involved in these attacks. And now we have a new statement coming from Justin Trudeau today, in fact, where he has had a bit of a change of plans. Justin Trudeau justifies refugee delay, saying liberals want to get it right. We're going to go to a video now showing you just what it was that Justin Trudeau had to say today. And following the video of his announcement of how they're going to be delaying this mission, we're going to be joined in studio by our guest Paul Verge to join me and James to discuss all of this. So here we have Justin Trudeau today announcing the new plans in regards to the Syrian refugee crisis.
One of the issues that we looked at more detailed is there a big difference between security screening done here in Canada and the security screening that can be done overseas? And we made the determination recently that doing the security screening overseas would allow not just for slightly better security outcomes, but it would allow Canadians to be more reassured. And like I said, we want these families arriving to be welcomed, not feared, because that's the way to get the right start in terms of having them become valuable parts of our community and create success.
Did you make that determination after the attacks in Paris?
The attacks in Paris certainly had an impact on public perceptions that was not negligible, but our...
Was that decision, though, made after the attacks in Paris?
The decision was made more recently, yes. So it was after the attacks in Paris, but it wasn't because of the attacks from Paris. There was a number of impacts, including the concern we had about the fact that when you're bringing over 25,000 people, the law of large numbers says there will be a few people who will be surprisingly problematic. And the fact that we might be stuck with people in a sort of legal limbo that we could not then allow to be walking around the streets in Canada, but we could not also return to a war zone, meant that there was a real challenge around not doing the processing over there.
How long until they're able to, as you say, walk around the streets of Canada? These are refugees, but they're going to be new Canadians as well.
Yes.
Will they be given freedom of movement as soon as they land?
Yeah, pretty much. There's going to be proper processing by the CBSA when they land, but the security checks and health checks and all that will be done on the camp side rather than here in Canada.
All right, folks. So as you can see, Justin Trudeau seems to have had a bit of a change of heart, or maybe it's not him. I mean, he's just a puppet after all. But things have changed today. And joining us in studio right now, we're joined by Paul Verge of TragedyAndHope.com. Paul, man, thanks so much for joining us here in studio. What's your take on the video you just saw? I mean, Trudeau has been saying all week that he's going to be bringing in 25,000 Syrian refugees before the end of the year. Now he's saying he's going to delay this plan. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think he was just giving kind of a political answer. I think it's very politically useful to wait until after Christmas to start this whole transfer because there's a lot of fear and heightened emotion and suggestibility around Christmas time. Mm. And waiting until after Christmas can mitigate that political risk because I personally think the refugee crisis is being used to spread a pretext mm-hmm. of having Syrians go to all sorts of different countries because if the powers that be wanted to start a so-called false flag terrorism campaign and then blame it on Syria or Syrian refugees, as it were, then it just further reinforces the need for more Western involvement. So I see it as kind of a potential honey trap. The problem is that the false dichotomy that's being set up with this narrative is not only confusing, as James was stressing in the last segment, but it's forcing people into a false dichotomy where both options, the black and white option, are both not feasible, not tenable, and not good options.
But this is so far from black and white, right? I mean, there's such a huge gray area here. James, what are your thoughts on what Paul was saying in regards to the psychological operation that's going on here? Would you agree with his analysis?
I couldn't agree more. I am as certain of that as I am of anything, that the Gladio B operatives will be implanted in these refugees that are going out to places for potential activation. I don't know if they're going to pull the trigger, but I am absolutely convinced. And people who don't know Gladio B, please do a start page search of it. It is the ongoing NATO operations to use Islamic terrorism as the next front for perpetrating its drug shipping and money laundering and terror and false flag incidents. I have no doubt there will be Gladio B agents implanted in here for potentially exactly what Paul's talking about. If they need to flip the switch in a certain country, do an atrocity here, do an atrocity there, get them on board with the agenda. The interesting part of this that I see is that there seems to be a countervailing tendency there. When you do that, when let's hope they don't, but if and when they do pull the trigger, literally, I guess, on a false flag operation using these embedded Gladio B operatives in the refugees, then they're setting up the space for the counter narrative to globalization, because all I see in this is a huge reaction in the public against exactly what they've been working towards for a long time, especially in Europe right now. We see that playing out in Europe, where people are talking about closing down the borders, which seems to be exactly against everything the globalists have been working towards with the European Union and basically dissolving the borders. The only thing that I can think of here is that this is the next stage of the crisis, that the solution is somehow going to be what we need is, you know, world control. And I think we'll see that instituted in Europe in some manner first. I really think they're going to try to come up with some sort of Europe-wide complete tracking and surveillance system, probably after a few more staged events. I mean, I'm not talking this is going to happen in the next year or two, but over time, this is going to be the continuing narrative. And I'm just wondering if they're building up an anti-globalization movement through things like this, and I wonder how that's going to play out in their obvious quest to try to continue to consolidate and centralize control.
Well, James, let me challenge you a little bit with this, as a voluntarist slash kind of anarchist. People sometimes wonder: is it necessary to use violence to the government to use violence to block the free flow of people who want to freely move. Should you know, it's such a tricky one. Should the borders be opened up, or should we be closing them down?
Excellent question. I'm glad you touched on that. In fact, that's something that's a debate that's raging right now in some libertarian circles. Lou Rockwell recently came out with an editorial saying that open borders are a violation of private property rights, because his argument is that because we are in this system where we are taxed by barrel of a gun, then technically public lands are really owned, kind of co-owned by everyone who's forced into that. And because we co-own it, we should have a say over who gets to be there or not be there. And if we don't have that say, then they're invading that space. And then there's zero aggression principle. I can't remember the name of the site, but they're arguing against that, saying that, well, no, because in a free society, that doesn't apply. It's an interesting sort of libertarian debate that's going on there. I agree completely that the answer to globalization is not nationalism, because nationalism is just the other stage of the dialectic that leads to globalism. You have nationalism, you pit it against regionalism, it's going to go to globalism. That is the inevitable logic of it. What we need is actual freedom, to people to disassociate their identity with some sort of abstract collective that they can salute and sing a hymn and salute the flag and give their identity over to that. That is the impulse which makes the globalist trick possible. One day it's not going to be you saluting your national flag, it's going to be you saluting the UN flag and singing the UN hymn, or whatever the equivalent will be whenever they finally get to that stage of the endgame. So I completely agree that this open border, closed border debate only applies in the world that we are in, where we have these governments telling people what to do at the barrel of a gun. In a truly free world, in a free society, yes, there would be no refugee crisis in terms of people stopping people at borders, except for people who obviously are, it would be in terms of people inviting people into their own property kind of thing. So yes, it's a completely different thing, what a 100% when we're talking about free society. But the point really is, we are not in anywhere close to even approaching a free world at this point. And so a lot of people, it's a real practical issue. What position do you take when there is no ideal alternative, even feasible, even fathomable at this point? And I think Paul hits it on the head. There really is no 100% good solution here. There's only a bad or another bad solution. And what do we do with that? There's only imperfection here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So we're just going to have to continue to dissect this one bit at a time. I want to take a couple of, we have a number of questions coming in from the audience. So let's take a couple of these questions for you guys. This one comes from Ricky from the Ripple Effect podcast. He read today that Hillary and Kerry had ordered down the shooting of the Russian airplane. Have either of you guys heard of that before?
News to me.
News to you. Okay. Well, there you go. I haven't actually heard that one either. Not to say that there's probably not some truth to that, but that's going to have to be looked into. Here we have a question from Happy Harry. How closely linked do you guys think that false flag attacks are to the impeding economic demise? Now, that brings me to a whole new topic. Thanks for the question, Harry. I want to get your guys' thoughts on where this is leading when it comes to the global economy. When we're in the midst of this war in the Middle East, this psychological operation with ISIS spreading across Western nations in Europe, well, what happens in the midst of that when the economy crashes? Is that something to be concerned about? And Paul, what do you think this could mean for the global economy? I know you're working on a documentary film right now, mm-hmm. Touching on this. Could do you see a global economic crash coming down the road? And as Harry asks, how much of that has to do with false flags?
Well, I think false flags throughout history have been useful for creating pretexts to put forth certain major changes in a culture or political landscape, especially for creating pretexts. But what a false flag is, what terrorism is meant to be, is a trauma on a population so that they go into a suggestible state. It's like post-traumatic stress disorder. You are more suggestible. And many of Adam Curtis's films have shown, when the public's in a suggestible state, that's when the most repressive laws are passed and the biggest introduction of radical, life-changing cultural values are put forth. So anytime you see any kind of attack going on, you immediately have to ask who's going to benefit from this. And so James mentioned how, you know, it defies logic for Turkey to want to get involved with Russia unless that's helping push forward a narrative that's leading to a third global kind of conflict, right? It really seems to me, having read Zbigniew Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard, that these are all the elements that fit into that narrative that he described. Mm-hmm. And there's many, many books that cover various aspects of this kind of narrative. But the biggest tool they're using now is to create all these competing and contradictory competing narratives that muddy the landscape and essentially confuse everyone so no one can launch a rational counter-narrative. And so that's why I think conversations like this are so important, because we're actually trying to dig through the nebulous cloud of mistruth and rumors and lies mm-hmm. to get to what's really going on so that we can identify the problem and actually take constructive action.
Yeah. Well, where should the debate be then? Should we be focusing on, you know, just the, how about the policy of non-intervention? or how about this concept of where did this start in the first place, right? Getting to the bottom of where this began?
Yeah, I think you have to contextualize the issue, because a lot of people only look back 15, 20 years in history. Mm-hmm. And if we're dealing with really extremist Islam is a relatively new phenomenon in the last century. It comes from Wahhabism, which is a Saudi creation. And the Saudis, as we know, were created by the British Empire, essentially at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 1900s, mm-hmm. To have this foothold in the Middle East. And they've become this politically convenient boogeyman, this extremist form of Islam that pretty much the rest of the Muslim world loathe, because it's so extreme and gives the rest of them such a bad name. So it's been convenient since 9/11, since all these different terror attacks, to tie it to different countries and kind of spread the idea of extremist Islam to various countries, when it really solely seems to come from Saudi Arabia. Mm. So in terms of pushing forth the global narrative that could lead us to a third world war, or could lead us to an overhaul in our social systems that includes totalitarianism, you've got to set up all the pieces, you've got to manufacture more and more conflicts, and don't forget that, like James mentioned, there's oil interests, there's banking interests. Everybody's making money off of every level of the conflict. Even the fear-based advisory for American travelers to not go out really means stay home and buy more stuff. It's Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's almost Black Friday in the United States. I mean, you got to get those shopping days in.
Exactly. So, Marilyn Manson talked about in one of, I think, Michael Moore's films, not to plug one of those films, but he talked about how when people are in a state of fear, they will go out and buy stuff and consume in order to numb themselves from the mm-hmm. fear. So anyone who turns on the news right now, they're going to see a really confusing narrative. They're likely to pick either let everyone in or don't let anyone in. Mm-hmm. And they're going to get trapped in this in narrower and narrower choices of what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the global social engineers are using Hegelian dialectics to mm-hmm. rope people into these. So the best thing you can do is not commit your emotions to any of these narratives and just use your critical thinking to identify what's really going on. And if you want to help people, go help them. Don't rely on the government to go help people, because they're one of the most inefficient entities in terms of taking your money and then misspending it on stuff that's not useful.
Bravo, bravo. Yes, 100% that.
Well, guys, in terms of the Hegelian dialectic, I want to touch on something now that it does need to be talked about, because a lot of people are concerned with this. And I'm touching now on what Albert Pike wrote about, this concept of the Third World War being between this Islamic ideologies and the Christian faith. And, you know, a lot of people are concerned, let's say, with, stats are coming out now that of the 2,600 Syrian refugees who came into America since 2011, I believe 3% of them were Christian and 97% of them were of the Islam faith, and this is new ideologies, new beliefs, new concepts coming into America and Western nations, and spreading their ideas here. Is this something that we should welcome? Is this something that we should be concerned about? I think a lot of Canadians right now seem to be concerned. What are your thoughts?
I'm happy to just briefly touch on that.
Yeah,
I think it's important to note that before 1900. That whole area in the Middle East had Muslims, Jews, and Christians all living in relative harmony. You know, mm-hmm. there's always going to be small scuffles here and there. But it was really the introduction, basically when the British funded the Saudi tribe into having this fake kingdom, they that foothold and then the creation of the State of Israel were the two things that gave them the ability to start fomenting conflict where there wasn't one before mm-hmm. by pushing more extreme versions of ideologies. And unfortunately, we're seeing these ripple effects from those actions so long ago in that people, they basically fear what they don't understand. To me, I have family members who are Christian, and I have family members who are Muslim. Mm-hmm. And so I've read both books. We've all read the Old Testament. The Abrahamic faiths essentially agree on like 85% of everything. Mm-hmm. It's these little offshoots that go off where the differences come from. And so it's actually really easy for people of those faiths to live together in peace and in harmony unless some third party or political influence comes in and starts meddling with that dynamic. And that's what we've seen with the British-American-Israel kind of coalition, is this attempt to come into the Middle East, everything from creating the Saudi kingdom to deposing Mossadegh to creating the Iraq-Iran war and arming both sides mm-hmm. to Afghanistan. Like, find any footage of Iran or Afghanistan in the 70s, and they were just as progressive as most Western nations. It's when the CIA come and fund extremist Islam to start taking over key areas that mm-hmm. you essentially have like this boogeyman balloon that's slowly being pumped up over time mm-hmm. because it's politically useful in the future. And so we have to be looking at who are our tax dollars going towards funding, right? If Stephen Harper wanted to buy or do business with Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is responsible for like all these atrocities and for trying to spread this damaging ideology, this, I call it basically the fake version of Islam, because mm-hmm. it's as popular with Islamics as Jehovah's Witnesses are with mainstream Christians.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's considered like a tiny offshoot. But in the media, who wants to play up the fear, it's spread out as if they call it the Muslim world, as if there's not Shia and Sunni and all these different offshoots that right. have completely conflicting ideologies. So just don't buy into the oversimplification of the narrative, and you know, try and research for yourself so that you can discover and mitigate the emotional reactions.
Yeah, yeah, and it's well put. I mean, that's essentially what it boils down to. And you know, just before we came to that, we were touching a little bit about just the what might come of the global economic meltdown that is to come. Tell us a little bit about your film that you're currently working on, because I believe that. Somebody recently said that these terrorists may be getting some funding from Bitcoin, and we're, you know, is this trying to make people getting them off of the track of being on you know, on this kind of money? Or, well, just tell us a little bit about what the
fuck. Yeah, well, to tie in Bitcoin, I mean, there's a lot of fears on both sides that Bitcoin could be used as a Trojan horse to create an electronic currency that could replace all cash mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, in the event of a global catastrophe, then, oh, here's this useful thing that we can suddenly introduce and make popular. But I've noticed that the powers that be seem to resist Bitcoin up until the point where the Alphabet Soup agencies basically formed a coalition to try and take over Bitcoin and start their own blockchain. Mm. And all the Bitcoin users in the know are resisting that blockchain. And if you're not familiar with Bitcoin or the blockchain, do some research on Bitcoin. All blockchain is a ledger that keeps track of every single Bitcoin transaction. So from what I know of intelligence agencies, they like to ship huge amounts of cash on skids to various parts of the world to give to people, hence trillions of dollars going missing all the time and they can't account for it. Bitcoin, with its blockchain ledger, tracks every single transaction. It still has a relative sense of anonymity until you try and convert it to fiat currency, mm-hmm. but terrorists trying to use Bitcoin, all their transactions would be tracked.
Right.
So it would actually work against them. The project that I'm working on that ties into Bitcoin and the blockchain is called Death Row Democracy. And what that actually focuses on, and this is created by my friends Christian Blaze and Crystal Dawn Rosales of Crystal Insight, essentially this project is about a concept, and this is a real site that exists on the dark web, but it's called the assassination market. And so Death Row Democracy is a futuristic story taking place in the not-too-distant future where there's been a huge move by the powers that be towards centralization, mm-hmm. and there's been generated a big decentralization movement that's as a counterbalance. And part of this dynamic is this website called The Assassination Market, which is essentially a kickstarting crowdfunding area for assassinations. Thankfully, in real life, nobody has gone through or followed through with these things, but we thought it would be artistically an interesting area to talk about, because a lot of people would consider that to be leveling the playing field, right? You crowdfund, you know, I think Ben Bernanke and like Henry Kissinger and people like that are actually on the real list. Again, I would advise no one to check it out or participate in that. But from a narrative perspective, it would be interesting to see, we felt, what dynamics that involves. And so we have a billionaire character, we have some activist characters, and we have that interchange and what happens. But we also have written episodes where the billionaires get into this and decide, how can I take out my political enemies using the same apparatus? So again, we want to stay away from the black and white. We want to explore the morality of not just Bitcoin, not just the assassination market, but all these other issues. We kind of want to use it as a ship to discuss these other pressing issues, especially centralization, which is really globalism, right? The centralizing of power into fewer and fewer hands, where there's less and less accountability. Mm-hmm. And so the assassination market is supposed to be bringing accountability back, right? It does go against the non-aggression principle. So I personally don't support the idea of the assassination market. But again, artistically, I think it's really interesting to explore. And the more I've learned about Bitcoin, the more I realize that self-generated currencies that have the integrity of the blockchain could be used for so much more than just Bitcoin. It could be used for contracts. It could be used for keeping track of politicians and what they're doing in terms of promise keeping. Like, there's just an enormous amount of application. And so with Europe apparently rumoring to want to ban Bitcoin when they've just recently accepted it, is a frightening thought. But again, in these dichotomy narratives, we have to be careful not to buy in fully on either side, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm still doing a lot of research, but you can check out deathrowdemocracy.com or deathrowdemocracy.bit if you want to learn more about that.
And awesome, and we'll have links to that in the description so you guys can check it out. James, as we start to close out the show here, and you know, let's touch a little bit more on the solutions. I mean, look into alternative methods of getting money and cash sent around is a good one. What else do you think people need to do here moving forward? Because we're going to be hit with an incredible amount of propaganda over the next coming days, weeks, and months. So what do you think people need to focus on right now, the viewers who are watching this right now, as they continue to pull this psychological operation off? What do you think we need to focus on moving forward from here?
There's so many things to focus on, and my focus of attention is now turning back to Paris, where they're going to parade on the dead bodies of the victims there to try to get a climate deal in place, a global climate treaty that's the next stage, or it represents one of the next stages of this whole process. So I think that's the next propaganda part we're going to have to focus on. But I think overall, the question of solutions is, as always, it's going to come back down to what we can actually do, as opposed to these meta-narratives over which, I mean, I don't certainly sitting here have any say over what Canada is or is not going to do with these refugees. I mean, we can pretend that there's some sort of political input in, through the public process in this, but there really isn't. And this decision is going to be made and the events are going to unfold. I guess the question is what we actually do with it on our own levels in the circles that we actually influence. So it always does come back down to what can be decentralized and in what ways can it be decentralized. So I talk about things like the peer-to-peer economy or agorism as ways of working around the system to the point where it is possible, it is technically possible, that we could completely replace the systems that we're on, the industrial corporate food chain and all of those things that keep us wedded into this system, that make us care about the position, the policies and positions that are being taken at the national and international level. We can create independent communities, communities of association that aren't necessarily physical communities, I think those as well, but also the communities that we create through associations of people all around the planet, of people of like mind. And that is ultimately, that is the only thing that can effectively combat the centralization of power that we see going on. I cannot guarantee, and I would not guarantee, that that is ultimately going to win out. Obviously, this is a huge, monumental problem, but I would suggest people go to CorbettReport.com, click on the Solutions tab in the Search by Tag area on the sidebar, and you'll find dozens of reports that I've talked about with all sorts of different ways that people can start to decentralize that power and bring things back into their own control, whether that's guerrilla gardening, whether that's creating your own media or finding and sourcing alternative media, whether that's the agorism or peer-to-peer economy, or the various things that we can do with each other. And that's ultimately, that's, I think, the solution we have to start focusing more on and start taking away some of our energy, our time, our attention that we give to the system every time that we're concentrating on what is their latest propaganda narrative. It shouldn't only be about dissecting everything that they're doing. It should be more focusing on what we can actually do.
Very, very well said, James. And you have been doing just that, bringing the community together, especially with your open source investigation into the Paris attacks. So I want to encourage people to definitely check out CorbettReport.com to get all of the latest there. So again, thank you so much. Paul, in closing, give us the links to where people can get involved with you, and what would you say is some of the things people need to focus on?
I definitely echo a lot of the same sentiments as James in terms of becoming self-reliant and independent is about withdrawing your energy from the systems that need your dependence and want to induce learned helplessness. Yeah, learning to feed, clothe, and house yourself, learning not to commit too much energy to the propaganda. Even analysis can create paralysis. If you spend too much time doing it, you're not going to be spending time taking constructive action in your own life. So, try and associate with people that will encourage. But, you know, if you're going to go out there and have debates with people, be respectful, be compassionate, have a little bit of empathy, because not everyone's going to necessarily be on the same page. And if you go to tragedyandhope.com, I'm pretty sure we've got a lot of James's work there, as well as Richard Grove, Brett Vinat, and many others. James Evan Pilato, of course, from Media Monarchy and New World Next Week. All great work and all great art. But yeah, just spend some time on doing some self-care and don't get wrapped up in the media narrative, because it's designed to manipulate your emotions. And, you know, that's intellectual self-defense means emotional intelligence. So that's real freedom. It's physical self-defense, intellectual self-defense, and non-aggression. There you go.
Very, very well said. Ladies and gentlemen, the enemy of the state is the person who has removed himself from the state, and the person who has gotten off the grid, the people who understand that global noncompliance is truly where it's at. I want to thank you for tuning in today, folks, and this has been a great broadcast. Share the link. Check the links in the description to where you can learn more from Paul Verge and also James Corbett. And we'll be right back here next week on Press for Truth Live. Every Tuesdays now is our new time. I want to thank you guys for tuning in. We'll be back right here next week. Take care.